session number 22170, rule 3.
Mr. Nick Berryman, rule 3.
This jailhouse in the centre of Arcadia was just what it was, a jailhouse. It was just a little box. It had two compartments in it. One was absolutely packed with roaring drunk Americans, and the other one was full of prostitutes. Now, we weren't drunk, so they shoved us in with the prostitutes. But at 4 o'clock in the morning, a chap called Lieutenant William Hart, I remember his name because I've just read a book about him. It's in a book called RAF Wings Over Florida. And in fact, I've still got his signature on the pass that I was given at that
time. Is this a recently published book?
Yes, a recently published book. And my son, who is now an airline pilot, got it from Florida. He brought it back and presented it to me on my birthday. And so I've read about William Hart again, and he's given credit as being quite a useful lieutenant. He was useful because he got us out of jug. But anyway, there were no charges levelled against us. But I think I must have put up another black. Because after continuing with my flying training up to 49 hours and 25 minutes, a figure indelibly imprinted on my mind, I was told that I was going to be given a 60-hour check. That was a check ride by an American flying instructor. And with his two bars on his shoulder and his pink trousers and his brown top and looking very much the lieutenant, he lowered his goggles, got in the front seat, I got in the back, and he said over the intercom, "Mister, I want you to take me off and give me a steep turn to the left and a steep turn to the right." And I did all this and brought the airplane in and landed it after doing everything I'd been told. Whereupon he got out of the airplane, looked at me very sternly and put his glasses on his forehead. His goggles went up. And I apologize for what I'm about to say, but you can only tell the truth. He said, "Mister, you's never go fly airplane as long as you got hole in your ass." And with that, I was scrubbed and finished with the United States Air Force. Done. As a 19-year-old cadet, I was absolutely broken-hearted. My flying career was over. But I was only alongside 50%, the 50% washouts on this particular Arnold scheme. This is ratified by what I've just recently read in this book, Wings Over, RAF Wings Over Florida. And the Americans were looking for West Pointers. They were looking for the best. And anybody that had put up any sort of a black, and I was no angel, was obviously going down the pan. And I was, after 49 hours and 25 minutes, scrubbed, finished. 49 hours and 25 minutes flying. But anyway, I spent one day went down to Miami, where some British cadets were being trained as navigators, and they were in Miami University. And having no money, or literally no money, I became a navigator overnight and got my bed and breakfast with the navigators. And I then came back on the Greyhound bus, and there was a board of inquiry as to why we had failed this flying test. And I found myself, I was in class 42F. We were known as class 42F. I found myself sitting alongside a very, very big and a charming man. He was a good 6'3", 6'4". He was 28 years of age, I later found out, and he was a Welshman. I'm sitting alongside him, and the court of inquiry was in an open office with the doors open in front of us. And he said to me in his Welsh voice, he said, "What you doing here, boy?" So I said, "I've been scrubbed. What's your name?" He said, "Arthur." And I said, "Mine's Nick." With that, Arthur was called in to the Court of Inquiry. I remember him marching in. Remember, I was 19 and he was 28. He marched in, came very smartly with a salute. And he said, "If you think," he said, "I've come all this bloody way to be told I can't fly after 25 hours, he said, "you're bloody wrong." And with that, he did a smart about turn and walked out. I later learned this was Arthur Rees, A.M. Rees, who was well known in British ragga circles for many, many years. Sadly, died not very far from here, not very far from Guildford, no more than 3 or 4 years ago. And he was capped for Wales, ragga. He was capped for Cambridge University, capped for the Metropolitan Police, and he was a man of tremendous stature and a great carriage. I, of course, was 10 years younger than he, with not that confidence. But armed with something that his words had said to me, "don't take this lying down," I marched in, came up with a salute, and I said, "and that goes for me too," I said. "Like that," he said. And with that, I marched out. Well, the long and the short of it was, we were the first British boys ever, ever to be sent from the United States Air Training Scheme to a British flying training scheme. And the British had opened up number one British flying training school in Terrell, just outside Dallas. And from Florida, we were put on a train overnight and dispatched to Dallas, where we both were given the same instructor, joined up with a course that had done approximately the same amount of flying, and we continued our flying on the PT-17-18s. We never looked back, either of us, from those days, strange to say. And we flew the BT-13As, which was a Vultee aircraft, which looked a bit like a Harvard with a fixed undercarriage and a 450 Pratt & Whitney Wasp engine, I think it was. And then from then on out, we progressed after a week's leave when we went up into Santa Fe and saw the Indians, and our education was further improved and how they lived. We progressed to our final stage of training, where we passed on to the Harvard or the 86 or the Texan, depending on what you want to call it. By this time, I had learned some of the perils of the air, having, I suppose, if you like, in the middle of another check ride, asked to do a slow roll, and ending up upside down with all my rudders locked solid, and I couldn't roll it out, because you roll the airplane out with the use of rudder and stick, and no way had I got any rudders, they were locked solid. Anyway, my instructor, who was the chief flying instructor, checking me out that day, he said, "we're in a bit of a mess," he said, "I'm going to try and land it." He said, "you can bail out if you like." Well, I didn't, never tried bailing out, and I looked at him and decided that he was a better flyer than I was, so I'd stay put. Anyway, God bless him, he did land that aeroplane beautifully.
How did he get out of that?
He handled it, I mean, locked rudders. That means basically you can't coordinate your control column and your foot pedals, but you've still got your control column. And by clever usage and careful usage of engine and his control column, he managed to put it down and put it down safely. So I was very lucky, really, to get out of that one in one piece. And then we passed on to the 86. And it was only about 2 weeks before passing out on the 86 that I took off one morning on a cross country. And the cross country was to go from Terrell to a little town called Shreveport in Texas. And when I arrived at Shreveport, I selected my undercarriage down and nothing happened. It wouldn't come down. So I got on the RT and told them that my RT, that I no way could I get my undercarriage down. And in no polite language, they told me to beggar off back and get back to Terrell and make a mess there rather than at Shreveport. So I got back to Terrell and I called up the control tower and I gave my call sign and said, this is B1180. I can't get my undercarriage down and I'm going to have to belly land. It was then that the chief instructor, a chap called Roderick, came on the RT and tried to persuade me that I had forgotten to do something. So I got a bit pompous and I said, no way, sir, have I forgotten any bloody thing. I can tell you, I have done everything. I've rolled it, I've looped it, I've put them down upside down, I've put them down the right way up. No way can I get my undercarriage down. And he said, okay, and he believed me. I dived it down from about 8,000 feet down to literally no feet and selected undercarriage down, tried to shake them down, they wouldn't come down. And then, so he said, well, line it up with a T and put it down on its belly. And that is exactly what I did. I think, in retrospect, it was a funny occasion because there was a lot of banging and dust and muck, but I made a fairly good job of it. And I do remember with a sea of British faces looking up at this very brave bloke in the sky in an 86 with his wheels stuck and the blood wagons and the fire engines and drama. I think it must have been Ensor all over again. I thought, I'm gonna use this.
Would you have had any feelings of fear?
None. Not fear, challenge. A tremendous challenge. I was going to use this. And I think, you know, I got it down okay. It's dust all over the place, bent propeller. But it came down and it landed nicely alongside the T. Straight away, the Wing Commander Hilton, the chief RAF guy there, was alongside me. He jumped up and said, get the engine switched off and get the fuel off. You needn't have worried. That was all off 10 minutes before before I landed. But anyway, I then tried to stand up and I couldn't stand up because I hadn't got any legs. So fear had bitten hard. I didn't show it and nobody ever knew. In fact, it's about the first time I've admitted to it, really. But there was a form that we used to have to fill in as to what your duty had been. And I said to the wing commander, I said, may I borrow a pen? He said, come on out. So I said, may I borrow your pen? So he gave me his pen and I sat there until I felt I'd got sufficient strength in my legs, and nobody ever knew that I was just chicken inside, but I'd hidden it. So I filled out this form 700, duty carried out, but undercarriage did not lower. I got out of the airplane, and I'm absolutely certain that nobody had ever known the name Berryman before, but they knew it from then on out, and I got a commission out of that. I think so. Because I was one of about 10 out of 50 of us that were commissioned from flying school. And I'm sure it was because I'd got a name. Positively. But that's beside the point. A couple of days after that, no, the next morning, I was flying with Arthur Rees again, and he was in another aeroplane. And another boy in another airplane. We were practicing formation flying for the first time. And this other lad suddenly had a fuel failure and his engine stopped. And we'd only got to about 1,500 feet. So he hadn't got very much time to make his mind up what to do. But he changed his mind at the last minute. And instructions were, and all our training was, if you had to land in a field, if it was possible to land along the furrows, never across the furrows. Anyway, at the last minute, he changed his mind because he was doing everything right. And he changed his mind and And the result was that the aeroplane's wing hit the ground and cartwheeled. And we really thought from above that he was going to be dead. But he wasn't. Taffy Davis was his name. And so I was in the sky with two Welshmen that morning. And Taffy Davis survived. And I remember laughing with him a week later when he was out of hospital. He came to on the frozen counter of a drugstore with ice cream lollipops being served over the top of him at a nickel a time. And then the Blumwagen turned up for him, put him in hospital for a week. And he did. He passed out and got his wings. Meanwhile, Arthur and I also passed out and got our wings. But not before I had had one more hiccup. Although later in life to become a motor engineer, I failed one more examination. And while about 30 boys were presented with their wings on a wings parade, we were humiliated to be told that we had to perhaps take an examination again, and if we failed, we would not get our wings. And it was engines exam I failed, and I think Arthur Rees had failed it. No, it was Harry Critchley. There's a name to conjure with. Harry Critchley, his uncle was Air Vice Marshal Critchley, a name that was well known in the Royal Air Force at the time. And Harry Critchley also failed his navigation. Anyway, the long and the short of it was that we watched the other boys get on a railway train presented with their wings, and we were kept back for about another 5 days when we took an examination again, and fortunately we all passed it, 19 of us, all passed it apart from one, and that was Harry Critchley. Even with an uncle with the name of Critchley, there was no way with the RAF. And all our results, you used to have to go back to Washington to be marked. Anyway, I was very sorry for Harry because he was a good friend of mine. And I remember that when we got on the train, I got my wings in my pocket and everybody else had had their wings sewn on. But I wouldn't sew my wings on because he hadn't got his. He did get his wings in the end. He went, got back as far as Trenton, which is in Canada, and he did some more training and spent the rest of the war bringing aircraft from the United States to England on lease lend. They were lending us airplanes, and so he was flying twin engine airplanes across to England, where his navigation could not have been too bad, so he passed his navigation exam. But meanwhile, that little act of mine, of not sewing my wings on, was remembered a good 25 years after, because I have a letter from the adjutant of that, of number one BFDS, a chap called Palmer, who was Flight Lieutenant Palmer, and he went into the Royal Air Force law, and he used to take all the court martials. And one day, quite by chance, he met me on Grantham railway station, at least 25, 30 years after. And he said, call on me and see me in London, if you possibly can. And he wrote me a letter which I've still got in my possession. And he said, so nice to see you on the station. I do hope I'll meet you again. I still remember your very human gesture to your friend by not sewing your wings on. Needless to say, of course, the moment old Harry Critchley was out of the carriage, when we got to Trenton, I got some French girl to sew my wings on a bit quick, because we were very proud of that. So we got back to Moncton, spent a couple of days there, and then climbed on board another troop ship and arrived back, having nearly been sunk once again, because the ship behind us was sunk. Well, no, it wasn't sunk. It turned back. It went back into Halifax, badly damaged. But, you know, we were going like a train at the time, and we arrived at Liverpool. And we went into Liverpool. I don't know that it wasn't. We went back into the Clyde. We did. We went back into the Clyde. And then took a train as still sergeants, because I thought I was still a sergeant. You know, given sergeant stripes, and sergeant stripe was sewn on my sleeve. And we came overnight from Greenock down to Bournemouth, where I was immediately told that I had been commissioned, and I was put into the Royal Bath Hotel, Bournemouth, where on my first night wearing an officer's uniform, I felt so embarrassed by a waiter that said, "What will you have to drink, sir?" that I said, "I'll have a whiskey and soda, please." I thought ordering half a pint of Malden bitter might offend him. So, and then something happened that has, without doubt, completely and utterly changed my life. While I was at Bournemouth, I got mixed up with three other boys that had been trained with me. But birds of a feather always flock together. And when we were in Dallas, it was obvious that Arthur and I, who knew one another, Arthur Rees, should become firm friends. And, of course, being older than me, he was like a dad to me, really. He looked after me, told me how to behave, told me how not to behave, all the dangers of wicked women, and all this sort of thing. And my other two friends was Billy Humphreys, and I spoke to him only two nights ago, now living in Scotland. Billy had passed his flying, and I met up with him again, because he had to wait in Bournemouth while we were kept back a bit. I don't even think we were on the same troop ship, but we might have been. I met up with Billy Humphreys again, I met up with Ray McNair Taylor again, and I met up with Charles Lawrence again. Billy Humphreys' brother became Chief of Defence Staff and died 6 months after taking the post, and was replaced by Neil Cameron, whom I also knew. I've already said that Ian Campbell would have become Lord Campbell of Nairn had he lived, but sadly he died in Italy escaping from the Italians, having been shot down in a Spitfire. And Ray McNair Taylor, who was just an ordinary sort of distant friend, I hardly knew him when we were being trained. And Charlie Lawrence. I did know Charlie Lawrence, but not too well. So my real friends were Arthur Rees, Ian Campbell, and Billy Humphrey. Spoke to Billy Humphrey about a week ago. He rang me. We only contact about every 3 years. He survived the war, having done 103 operations on the mosquito. 103. So I suppose we class boys of 1941 did manage to pull our whack a bit. Having got into Bournemouth and being told that I was a pilot officer, I was given leave. And I went to London, where I took a taxi to my home in Queen Anne's Gardens, Ealing, London W5. My mother didn't know I was going to arrive. And I think on my last four bob, I'd paid for a taxi. And I arrived at the front door, having been away almost a year. And I saw my parents' light on above the main door. And suddenly the light came on, and my mother appeared at the door. She was a very beautiful woman with hair that was plaited down her back. And she looked at me in my Air Force uniform. And tears ran down her face, and she said, "My lamb, my lamb." And it was a wonderful moment to be home. I think I'm only telling you that story to tell you we were a very close family. And And my father was, of course, absolutely delighted to have me home and terribly proud to have a boy with wings on his chest. From having got over my leave, which I was given almost a week's leave, once again back to the London Palladium, joined up with a girlfriend that I'd have known in the YMCA, YWCA, and I realised I was getting very fond of her. And her name was Betty. And I was posted to number 17 AFU Wotton, Norfolk. 17 AFU was an advanced flying unit, and the purpose of which to go to was to find out what it was like to fly in England instead of the big wide open spaces and the big wide open prairies of the United States. And believe you me, it's a very different thing when you're flying over England with a multitude of lovely little fields and tiny rivers and a tiny coastline, to flying over a desert where you've got one road that goes east and west and one that goes north and south. And we had to very quickly learn to learn to fly in England. And we were given about a fortnight to do this.
What time of the year was it?
October 1942. We were given Miles Masters to fly. Remember, we'd flown the PT-17, the BT-13A, the Harvard, and now here we were given the Miles Master. The Miles Master was the acknowledged aeroplane given to British chosen single engine pilots, because this time when we went, not for one moment did some of us realize that we were going to be single engine pilots until this time. We could have been posted anywhere. But to go to 17 AFU on the Miles Master, it was almost certain that we weren't going to fly the Oxford. And the Oxford was a twin-engined Oxford that the bomber boys would have flown. So I went to 17 AFU together with Ray McNair Taylor, Charles Lawrence, and Paul Mercer, and we got on with our flying training. Obviously, although I'd passed out with an above average grade in flying school, despite being washed out by the Americans, I did get an above average grade. So I obviously learned something. But the Miles Master, I did find a bit of a handful. I thought they were underpowered. I didn't like them from the word go. I only flew them for 21 hours total. And in that time, I'm not very proud to tell you that I broke the tail wheels off two of them, set fire to a third, and completely destroyed a fourth. However, some of it comes out later in the story, I've no doubt. From making good friends and keeping those good friends at Wotton, Norfolk, we found ourselves posted to a Hurricane OTU at Annan in Scotland, very near Gretna Green.